collective bargaining, July 20th, 2016.
Here are the minutes for June 29th, 2016.
Big no no. Mine's with a Y, so it's clear. It's one of the few things that happened.
Well, I was wondering, you put Patty when she wrote Patricia.
Yeah. But it's P-A-T-T-Y.
All right.
Well, that's like Sherry. I get R-I-E a lot, or R-I, yeah, all the time.
We need to fix that on the last one, too, because it's P-A-T-T-I on the June 1st, 2016.
Must have been just creating student essays.
Autocorrect was on in your brain.
Sometimes you start to think, I can accept this. You get into that mindset.
Yeah, just a minor note, at the end of last session, we agreed that we put the agenda on the handouts, and we had no indication of that here.
What?
Charlie, you said you would put the prospective agenda on the next handout, the articles that we would discuss.
So you'll have a June 1st, 2016 minutes?
Well, we still have all four. Okay.
The articles that we discuss in the next session, I thought that was understanding. And it's totally neglected here.
Okay, so articles discussed. What are we talking about today?
We still got all four on the table.
So, specifically, it was Article 8, I think, right?
Mm-hmm.
Any other corrections from our side? I think it's otherwise good from our side.
Okay, good. I have no changes to it. Sure. Did you say you have some questions, Trump? Oh, on this. You're going to take care of it. Good. Okay. What do we have, John?
We've got 24, unless you have something you want to start with.
We have a couple, but why don't we start with 24?
Oh, okay. Your version of 24 or our version?
Your version of 24.
Okay.
And then we'll give you an 8.
Good.
And then we can both take a caucus and look at our respective articles.
For sure. Well, I'm trying to make it easy to spot where the changes are and to identify what they are. Except for I wasn't consistent. So I want to make sure I tell you the right things. Or I point out the right things. So, do you guys need a copy? Sorry.
I'll do it.
Yeah, okay, yep.
All right. So, 24.1 through 24.4 are unchanged from our previous proposal. In 24.5...
Can I ask you just one quick question?
Mm-hmm.
On 24.4, do you intend to do something about America at some point?
We might or might not.
Okay.
We're sort of waiting for the upcoming consultation to to see what's going on with the policies and stuff.
Oh, we pulled it off the table.
Oh, okay. So it's just totally. Oh, okay.
I think that's resolved, it's not, right?
Yeah, that you guys were going to do it. And we told the Senate you were going to.
Okay.
Because they've traditionally done it. We said, nope, union wants it, so.
Okay. All right. So then the other change is in, the first change actually is in 24.5. D, yes, on page 2. It's in red. I should have highlighted that. I apologize for that. I tried to highlight all the changes. So this particular change is, as you might imagine, motivated by past events with the legislature. And so it's designed to maintain the current benefits for the duration of this contract and to protect us from any changes that might come in the future legislative sessions. And I think you can imagine with the way our government is going nowadays and the conventions before us that there's a lot of uncertainty about exactly what's going to happen come November. So that's the motivation behind that. In 24.6, everything that's in gray except for that struck out section in 24.6A1, mm-hmm. those are all taken from your proposal and just imported in. So I left the one in gray because it was in your proposal and then we took it out. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to explain the rationale for that. And we talked about it a little bit last time. So if we set the expiration date too early,
yeah,
then folks won't sign up, right, because of Social Security and other things. And so then we were trying to figure out, okay, what's the best date? And then as we discussed that among our group, we didn't really see a rationale for setting any date because imagine a person who's not going to enroll in phase retirement, right? Mm-hmm. They're going to just give their notice at a certain point, and then they're going to retire, you know, quickly thereafter. So you don't really have a set date for them. The whole rationale here is for both sides, is to let the employee kind of wind down, you know, as they need to. And so the university derives benefits from that, and obviously our members do too, or our bargaining unit does too. But it also provides departments and the university time to plan ahead. And so if we just leave it open, I think we gain all those advantages, and I don't see that we lose anything. Mm-hmm. Whereas if we set a date, then we just have that same problem. It may only capture a few people, but mm-hmm. we just didn't see where having a date gained us anything. And I don't know if that's your perspective or not.
Yeah.
We just didn't see any harm in just leaving it open.
Okay.
Yeah, and like at the bottom of 24.6A2, that the numbers where they're in parentheses, I struck those out as I found them. It's like, darn, those things keep mutating. And all right, so then we come on page 5 to 24.7. So on this one, we responded to your concern about immediate family members being too broad. So we changed the language so that it covers spouses and then registered domestic partners, since that's a possibility in some jurisdictions here. And then children, stepchildren, and adopted children, that category, who are under 26 years of age, and then and other dependents. And so that narrows down mm-hmm. the immediate right. family to just folks who are in the household dependent on the employee for financial support. And so the rationale for that one, again, is that back in the 60s, we had a lot of folks with a, you know, I don't know what you call it, traditional nuclear family with two parents and children, and now we're down to, I think the last stats I saw was 50%.
Yeah.
And so this will cover the cases of, say, someone who has guardianship of a grandchild and expand that benefit. And I believe that's it.
Okay.
Does anybody have any questions before we move on?
I just want to understand this registered domestic partner in some jurisdictions. I didn't understand that statement.
Well, it's there's not a statewide registry right now in Florida.
Right.
There are in other states. But there is one for the city of Orlando, for Orange County.
I was going to say, I knew Orange County.
Yeah,
yeah. And there are some others. It's not
40
it's not universal.
Overall. There are 40 different ones throughout the state, 40 different jurisdictions.
So domestic partner is any kind of couple, same sex, opposite sex?
Yes, same sex, opposite sex, but there's a formal list of criteria for that, you know, having financial interdependency and in the same household.
I just want to understand the definition.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I have a question for you.
Okay.
St. Mary, you, after the first yellow highlighting, you say may enroll for a combined 12 credit hours of courses per term, but then after that you say employees may enroll in no more than 6 credit hours per semester.
Right. And that's pretty common language because the employees are full-time employees, and so you wouldn't expect them to also be full-time students to use the 12 hours. So they would be limited to 6. So let's say that if I was the employee and I'm taking courses the way some of our employees do, I would could have up to 6, and then that would leave 6 available for someone
other.
Else. Yeah.
Okay. Right.
That's pretty common, even in other states too, where they limit employees with the idea that being a student is a full-time job.
With a person back in Milwaukee, actually got a law degree.
Okay.
Here's
just wanted to ask a question on the optional retirement, that change. When you're talking about we'll enter into immediate negotiations for the purpose of arriving at a mutually satisfactory mechanism, what are you thinking that we would, is the idea that we would negotiate to present some sort of joint statement to the legislature or something? I mean, what's the point?
No, it's actually to fix the problem.
Right.
So
it's the same language. I imported a lot of that language from Article 29, I believe. Yeah, from 29.2, it's at the trail end of 29.2.
Mm-hmm.
Only that article talks about replacing a provision, which didn't really apply to this case.
Right.
Well, you know, the problem I think with the way, and we'll talk about it in caucus, but just something that jumps out at me, is it seems to suggest that if there's a change in legislation having to do with the Florida retirement system, for example, I'm just saying that's not all, but let's say for the Florida retirement system, that we would not make the change in the law. We would not effectuate the change in the law.
Right.
And then we would go and negotiate it. But, you know, the problem with that is we don't control the Florida retirement system. So, for example, and I'm not saying this is a change, but I'm using this just as an example. Let's say, for example, the law changes so that the Florida retirement system says all new enrollees after a particular date will go into this plan, which might be a defined contribution plan. Well, we could not continue to enroll people in a defined benefit plan after that date because the Florida retirement system won't take them. So there's no way we could continue to maintain a practice that is not authorized by law. That's just a point I'm trying to make. Now, what we have in 29 is a recognition that if the law changes and impacts the contract, that we get back together and negotiate over that change. But in particular, I think in the area of retirement, as a benefit provided by the state, defined by the state, we have to comply while we were negotiating.
Right, but what we're envisioning is a case, so in that case that you referenced, if the projected benefits are the same, then there's not any a decrease in the benefit. It's just a different plan. But if there's a decrease in, say, the contribution, different caps or something like that.
Well, what if they say after a certain date, when we enroll people, they're going to have 30 years to get to this point instead of 20. They're not going to cut a check 30 years from now, you know. They're not going to cut a check 20 years from now. They're
right.
Gonna, they're going to say you get another 10 years.
Right.
There's nothing we can do about that. I mean, we can't, like I guess what Sherry was saying, we could always express a desire to have the law different. In some instances, we might be able to negotiate something that would be an alternative.
Right.
But
that's
not
what
always.
We're trying.
But not always. You know, not in every case will there be an alternative available to us, because we kind of run into the same thing in insurance, you know, because we're obligated by law to participate in the state group insurance plan that's designed by the legislature. And it could change. It does change every year, actually. And it changes in a way that we don't really talk about very much. But you know, every year the cost of state group insurance increases significantly, really significantly. And the legislature comes in every year and says, okay, should we reduce benefits? And they have up until now, like the last 6 or 7 years, said we're not touching benefits, and we're throwing this huge infusion of money into the trust to cover the difference. They've been picking up the increase of state group insurance for maybe 7 or 8 years, and it's a lot of money. It's, you know, it can be $1,000 per participant per year. When you think about state group insurance, it's hundreds of thousands of people. But so there's changes, but we can't control that. If next year they say to us, we're not going to pick this one up this year, we're going to have an increase in rates. So when you go sign up for state group insurance, that's what you're going to pay. Now, could we come to the table and say, we're going to try to ameliorate this somehow by giving people bonuses or something? You know what I mean? I don't know. I mean, certainly that's it. But to make the statement in a contract that we will not comply with a change in the law, I don't think we can do.
Oh, it's very carefully crafted to not do that.
Well,
it says needs to have a mechanism to counter the effect.
It says
the law.
It says the parties
to restore the benefits to their previous level.
It says the parties agree to be bound by any changes in the statute or regulations unless such changes decrease benefits. So that's basically saying if someone were to make the argument that the benefit decreased, that we would ignore the law. Just that's the way it's worded. Maybe that's not the intent.
Yeah, it's not the intent.
Right, that's not the intent.
It isn't compelling. All it's saying is that we would get together and come to a mutual.
No. I'm talking about the sentence before that.
Yeah,
the sentence
before
that says, right, if there's a decrease in benefits, we will not effectuate it. And I don't think in all cases we're able to make that statement in a contract.
I'm not interpreting it that way. I'm sorry.
Well, it says the part.
Well, we could. That's
It says the parties agree to be bound by any changes in statute and regulations. Okay, that's good. Unless the changes decrease benefits to employees.
Uh-huh.
So there's no unless. It decreases benefits to employees, if you understand what I'm saying. We can't make that distinction.
Right, but there is a continued sentence after that.
I understand that.
I think we could.
I think
it clarifies, but I know what it does. But what it's saying is, what do the parties, what are the parties' position while they're doing those negotiations? And the party's position is, has to be to comply with the law while we talk about the impact of the law. We can't say, since this decreased benefits, we're not going to comply with the law.
Well, maybe I think there's along the line that you would make a good faith effort to minimize.
No, I've got something that's much simpler than that. It's simply to, at the beginning of that red phrase, replace that comma with a period and just strike the rest of that sentence. So it says the parties agree to be bound by any changes in those statutes and regulations, period. And then if a change in statute or regulation decreases benefits, now we're in compliance, okay, then it invokes this next sentence.
That, without having talked to my team in caucus, that makes me feel better about the language.
Okay.
Now, it's good to be clearer on the language.
Yeah. I mean,
we all know that, but just pointing that out again. The better we can get it, the fewer problems we have down the road.
Did I pass this out?
We already got it.
Yeah. Oh, you already got it?
Yeah,
okay,
we already got it.
Okay. So here is an article that's on. Okay. We have four colors. Oh. Actually, we have five colors.
Oh, no.
That's six.
Just a second.
Six.
I just want to make a note.
Just the computers.
Is red the newest language?
No, I don't know. It just depends on whose computer we were working on.
I got it.
Changes.
Okay.
It's not relevant.
Okay.
Cool. There's language at 8.7 on overload appointments that's largely new. On the bottom of page 3 of 5, and it continues on to page 4 of 5. And, Chuck, would you mind explaining the need for that language?
There are occasions when, with a contractor or grant, particularly a contract, that there is overload pay that's to come to faculty, and usually it's a fixed amount. At present, without the provisions that we're suggesting in the contract, the FTE of the employee, the faculty member, has to be adjusted. And because sometimes the contract says there's a fixed amount, $1,000, let's say, that goes to each of half a dozen people that are involved in this. So everybody's going to get $1,000. There are some very senior faculty, there are some junior faculty. The FTE can be very, very different, and it distorts what's really going on, because it appears that the younger faculty member or the faculty member with a lower salary is working lots harder than the senior person. So what we're asking for is, in a case like this where it's specified that everybody's going to get a lump sum, we think it would be simpler from our perspective, and it seems simple enough, just to say we're going to pay this in a lump sum. That's how it's really specified in this contract, that it's a lump sum, and then rather than having to force it into the university's payroll system as an FTE, let's just do this, these special circumstances. I don't know how often they come up, but they do come up. Let's just do it in one of two ways. We either break it up into some of the biweekly, a few installments, or we do a lump sum at the end of the completion of the work on the contract. And then we don't have to mess with the FTEs. As I've thought about this part of what we're proposing, what sticks out in my mind, maybe I've got a good example, maybe not, is in the summertime when FTE is really critical. And now if I could see this potentially hurting a junior person who's going to get this lump sum payment, but for that particular person, it's a big FTE. And now it may not work out so well to toss that on top of a summer appointment that includes teaching and so on. They may not be able to claim that full amount of the lump sum. So we're proposing to ensure that the payment actually goes to the employee in the amount intended. If in just this case, not ENG funds, just CNG funds, when the contract calls for a lump sum payment, we'd like to be able to do that.
So can you give me a for instance, like what sort of classes of, I've never seen this, that's why.
The examples that are a different college.
It sometimes comes up in education, for example. And they'll get these grants to write curriculum. And they'll name four people on the grant. And they'll say, okay, everybody gets paid. It's going to consist of four modules. Each person writes a module. Each person gets paid $2,000 for that module. And it can be anybody from an assistant professor or even an instructor to a full professor. And so if you're messing with FTEs, it looks like the full professor is working for what they're getting. It makes one person look like they're working a whole lot harder than the other person because the percentage of their FTE is higher. That $2,000 is a whole lot more percentage of somebody's FTE for one person than it might be for another. So we have to jiggle the FTEs to make it look.
It's not representative of the effort.
Is supposed to be. Yeah.
Well, that's what I'm trying to figure out. Is it a compliance issue?
I guess the grants in education are flat rate as they come to the, they come into the university and they're, so they say, okay, we got four people and we need each of you to do the same task, same identical task, but we don't have a mechanism to give them a lump sum payment to pay them that task.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm just not getting it because we have this all the time of like NSF grants with three PIs, each with different salaries. So I guess the difference is that usually we do it on a monthly basis. So whoever's got the highest salary is getting more per month, oftentimes for the same work. And then if we want to, equilibrate it, we just alter the FTEs ourselves.
See, that's what I mean. You're altering the FTE.
So why doesn't that work? I mean, that's what we're doing already.
Well, Sherry's a very senior faculty member, and I'm a very junior one. She makes twice as much as I do. She makes $100,000, I make $50,000. So we both have the same task to do. We both have to develop a module. It's exactly the same work, but she's going to look like she's worked half as much as me for the same amount.
Well, how's that different now? If a full professor has, a certain percentage FTE assigned for teaching two courses, and so does an assistant professor, but they make different amounts. I mean, why would it matter?
They're doing the same amount of work.
But the FTE is still the same, though.
Exactly.
So.
Yeah, I mean, what's the point?
The salary and FTEs are not always different. Linked together.
Right.
And what the question Lee's posing is, well, that's just how it is. I mean, they're just not linked together. I mean,
right.
My FTE is 1%. I make very different than a full professor.
Well,
so what we're not understanding is why is, how is this linking the FTE and the salary together when in normal operations it's not really linked together?
Right.
Yes, it is. You're paid an hourly rate. I'm making something like $50 an hour. You're paid for one FTE, you'll get that $50 rate. Now, if I'm paid $30 an hour, I still work one FTE. I get paid a different rate because the rates are different. We're saying the output is it's a flat rate.
So there's not a
math thing that I'm struggling to.
Yeah, I think the example that you provided, the FTE is the same.
Right.
And as a result, the pay is different because there's different salaries.
Right.
What we're talking about is a different kind of example where the amount is the same, but the FTEs are different.
Yeah, right. So I guess if you make $100 an hour and the project is going to pay everybody $2,000, you would be 20 hours, right? Mm-hmm. But if you're making 50,
sure.
The project says it's 40 hours, but sure, both people are actually using the same amount of
time. Yeah, we get that. So you're just going to adjust the FTE to make it look good or something?
No.
We don't want to do the opposite.
Because instead of sort of creating an FTE fiction, mm-hmm. in order to get to the rate that the grant is providing, we want to just go right to the rate that the grant's providing. Is that right?
Well, yes, but I'd add on to that. The grant really isn't providing a rate. It's providing a lump sum.
Right.
Yeah.
So we would like to actually pay people as it's prescribed in the contract, exactly as it's prescribed in the contract.
Well, if we did that, we'd have to redo half of what our ORC does, because half of our contracts are fixed rate. And so we're forever jiggling things, you know. So it's, you've got a deliverable, you get paid X amount for this deliverable. We're constantly keeping two sets of books to keep track of, here's the agency's deliverables and how much we're taking in, and here's the ORC budget. I mean, I've got dual books on everything with the water management district.
You might be confusing the fixed contract rate with the fixed rate to the person. Because you can have a fixed rate contract that doesn't specify individual.
Right, but it's the same idea, is that you're keeping dual books to keep track of things. You've got a lump sum, and the water management district is just going to cut you a check as you get those amounts, those tasks accomplished, but then those get partitioned differently once they go to ORC.
Those are your billing, yeah. Those
are different. No, uh-uh. It's based on accomplishment of a task.
When you say you're keeping different books, it makes me very uncomfortable.
The book that matters is ORC's.
That's a metaphor.
Yeah. In the summer, what I was mentioning would be a possibility somebody could be over 1.0 FTE, and you know, what do we do? Not pay them everything that they've got coming to them. We'd like to be able to just pay. This is what the contract says. This person, each of these four people, should get $2,000. We'd like to have the ability just to do that
without worrying about the FTE.
So this is solely for overload appointments. Would it
solely CNG compensation to handle those events when it's a lump sum compensation model?
All right, and would it affect anything else? Any retirement? Anything else that's
a lump sum?
It's still the same. It's money.
Yeah.
It's compensation.
So it's going to come in that way.
It's going to be taxed. Everything.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking about, is tax and fringe benefits will alter any of
the... Ultimately, it's the same amount of money, because I think our only other option is to jiggle with the FTE, but that's going to... It has the potential for sending people into over 1.0 FTE, which would be bad, then you can't pay them. So it's looking to fix the problem, but it's, you would get paid the same amount of money either way.
Really, what we're trying to do, the example that we have for the summer, I think is the one that convinced me how good this is. We're trying to make sure that the faculty get paid what they're supposed to get paid. Because we see the potential that, particularly for a young faculty member who may be teaching a couple of classes in the summer and has this other obligation, and we're trying to add this on, we can't.
But it's only for, it's for CNG funding.
Right. Yeah.
It's just CNG funding. Right.
Okay. Right. Sorry, my brain had substituted CNG employee in there.
No.
CNG funding. All
right. Yeah, these are like...
Oh, no, it's not just CNG.
It's EMG employees who get a grant in the summer.
So here's a consequence of a morning bargaining session. You're seeing it right there.
I like the idea of 4:30. Can we bring that up again?
Except I'll come there from the other side of the clock.
Yeah, I would too. Stay up and then get up.
So see it. We'll have to. We're trying to make sure that there's not some unintended consequence that.
Yeah, no, we get it.
And so.
We like to be alerted to unintended consequences as well.
And so the major place that you've encountered this issue so far has been education.
Yeah. Because they
engineering
get,
or no?
I don't know of any in engineering.
Yeah. So mostly education.
They get, they're teaching in the summer, but they also get these curriculum writing grants.
Sometimes it doesn't stick to just summer. Sometimes it starts in March and ends in July or ends in October, and so it's going up and down and up and down, and the lump sum would just even it out. Keep everybody's FTE the same, so the effort looks the same. It's just not fair to senior faculty member. It looks like they're only working 25% of the time. We literally had someone who made twice as much as someone else.
So
made twice, how?
Someone whose earnings, their salary was over $100,000 and the other person was $50,000. So the FTE made it look like the person with the big salary wasn't working hardly at all, because when you change the FTE to get the amount that you're going for, because we're looking for an amount, it's not fair to them. It doesn't look right. I'm sorry.
All right. So that was my question. So 1.0 FTE equals your salary.
Yeah.
And so say you're making $30,000 and you got a $10,000 grant, you'd need to bump up that FTE to 1.33 in order to pay out that person.
I'm looking at my math.
Yes.
Doing a great job, Nick.
And so someone's making $60,000, you only have to up at 1.166? I don't know. You only have to up at half, right?
I prefer to think of it without even going over. You know, if you have someone at $30,000 and you pay them 0.33 FTE, the other guy's only one. You know, it's half. Yeah. And that doesn't look right when you're trying to report and evaluate. Yeah. You're evaluating this person on less time because that's the FTE, right? And you want to do it on the project. That's what the concept is.
So then this could affect on P&T awards, stuff like that, where FTEs are reported, right?
Well, I mean, it wouldn't affect the TIP award because it's research work. It's not teaching.
It could affect the analysis of how much time someone spent on that.
It could penalize
a category.
Right, a
category, right.
Unintended. Unless we fix it.
I'm gonna throw this open to the folks in the back. Is anything, you guys have any questions on that, or anything that comes to your mind from your colleges, sure, your experience? Questions you want to ask?
I can, if you want me to.
It's self-explanatory.
No,
we'll wait and see if they have questions.
Direct compensation was provided to faculty from any grant sources, or maybe for other means, that's how they
do. Okay. Dan, can you? I'm just trying to. We'll talk about it. But in case they had questions, that might, where you guys could help us, so we don't go off on tangents.
And there's some other new language throughout A and in caucus. If you want to read through it, then we'll be ready to answer any questions you might have about it.
Study abroad. We typically think of study abroad as just being summer programs. But we do have programs that, you know, these short programs that will go like over winter break or over summer break, and I mean spring break. And what we're saying is those are that because people are still on contract, those, you know, we're not going to pay them at like the summer rate. They'll either do them in load or they will do them on an overload basis, because it's not. Mm-hmm. Not summer.
I'm just not sure why this language is necessary. Is that sort of understood by everybody, right?
Well, I think it's because we're doing. I don't know that it's understood by everybody, and this is something that we're starting to do more of these programs. I think Ross does one.
I do a spring term.
Yes, a spring term one. Yeah. So I mean, and just so that there's just it's a clarification, because we put so much stuff into the contract about study abroad that we didn't used to have. We want to make sure that all these different variations of study abroad are understood. And We do, we are trying to come up with a new program that would allow students who are members of underrepresented groups, Pell Grant eligible or first generation in college, to have an opportunity to do a study abroad. And I don't know how this is still in the concept stage, I think, but we really are trying to expand that program and make it available to more and more people, and people who would not otherwise have the opportunity. And we are would like to have the option for a faculty member, if they choose, if they want to, take one of these groups to volunteer to do it, just on the basis of they would get travel, housing, and expense determination, but they could choose not to receive compensation other than that. There's no hesitation, except that when you get these groups that are so underrepresented and poor, that just adds a cost that probably puts it out of their reach. We're pretty close to the edge right now on a lot of study abroad programs. We've had to drop a lot, actually, or drop some since we've gone to paying the regular summer rate for faculty. We're getting really close to pricing ourselves out of the market on that. So we certainly don't want to disadvantage people who, you know, might otherwise not have the opportunity to do it.
So why not just deal with that directly by offering those student scholarships? That's almost every university I'm familiar with does that, virtually all.
I think we're offering them scholarships for a lot of the travel and the per diem and all of those things, but there's only so much we can cover.
Well, usually that limit is the cost. I mean, I've got a former student that at Denison University, they actually had to write a rule. It's called the Welter Rule, that students can't be overcompensated for the cost of study abroad, because somehow with all her scholarships, she went to Australia, and because of the difference in tuition and the dollar exchange at the time and stuff, the university actually had to cut her a check. And so she made money on the whole deal, which wasn't her intent. But then they had to come back and say, okay, we're only going to fund up to the limit.
Well, something to think about.
It's interesting.
Yeah, I mean, we really are.
But I would say it's of very limited interest to our members.
Oh,
or
sure.
To our bargaining unit, when they're asked to provide work for free for things that the university could provide other resources for, including scholarships.
Right.
It's work for no salary. It doesn't mean it's for free. There's plane tickets, there's housing, and there's other costs.
But there's no compensation.
Right.
And
that's a generally accepted principle here in the United States, that folks get paid for their labor.
Traveling with students is
not
a vacation.
Well, it's
for the record, a member of the bargaining team who's recently won this visit.
Well, you know, there again,
vigorously shaking his head in agreement.
We may have not a single faculty member, and that's okay too. That's why it's on a voluntary basis. Yes, you want to give out.
We're also going to give you an Article 3, but we have an issue that we want to talk to you about with Article 3. The language change that we have is a clarification, because...
you have another one, Mike?
Oh, yeah, sure, I'm sorry. Here's...
You printed them, we might as well use them.
Yeah. Well, we wanted to clarify under 3.4 something that I think we all understand, which is that union activity done pursuant to this part is not an assignment, and it's not to be included on an evaluation. We just want to be, there was some lack of clarity on that. We wanted to make that clear. Now, we have another issue with all of this, which we're going to need to talk about. And I probably need to get you a copy of this case decision. But about a month ago, the Florida Public Employees Relations Commission issued a case called, her name is Dr. Pinto Allen versus Miami-Dade College and the United Faculty of Florida. And what happened there is the president of the chapter at Miami-Dade College was released. And he was released to do activities that were in support of the union as an organization, and also some activities that were representational in nature. And the Public Employees Relations Commission said that when a public employee is released from any duties to engage in work that's done in support of the union as an organization, it cannot be compensated by the public employer. So it can be, they have to do it on their own time or take leave, or they have to reimburse the university for that portion of their salary. They, you can continue as a public employer to release people for representational activity, which PERC defines as, there's three categories, and I think I'm missing the third one, but one is conducting collective bargaining with the public employer. Another is representing a bargain unit member in a grievance meeting or hearing. But they said that the activities that this particular gentleman engaged in, which included union meetings, organizational meetings, solicitation for membership, writing newsletters, attending statewide meetings, could not be performed during release time that had compensation attached to it. Now, all of this flows from the fact that in the Public Employees Relations Act is a sentence that says no public funds will be used in the support of a union. And so that's been in the law for. Now, so we have to kind of look at 3.4. In that, and I'll get that copy of that for everybody.
Can you remember the name of it again?
Pinto Allen.
Pinto Allen versus Miami-Dade College.
Pinto Allen?
Yeah, it's Dr. Pino. Pinto. Pino?
Isabel Del Pino Allen.
Yeah, that's it.
A-L-E-N.
Okay, what was that again?
Isabel Del Pino Allen versus United Faculty of Miami-Dade College.
Now, if you go to about the third to the from the last page, the Public Employees Relations Commission says that since they're taking this interpretation, they're not finding Miami-Dade College to be subject to a remedy, but they direct all public employers in the state of Florida to go to their collective bargaining agreements, and if they have any language or practice of release time that varies from the articulated rule, that they're to address it immediately. So we're all charged with this. I mean, I don't think it means all of us have to fall out of our chairs about this. I just think we need to look at that case law and see that we're saying the right thing.
We have to get that case law.
Right? Yeah. Yeah. So, okay. Right. Yeah. All right.
But I think do you know when that sounds like you have it pulled up on your screen?
It's
do you
about
know
when 6 weeks
that decision?
Ago.
About June 22nd.
June 22nd. Okay. Yeah. That is very recent then.
Yeah.
What level of court is this?
The
Public Employees Relations
District Court of Appeal.
Well, yeah, but this is the thing about that is, it is on appeal, but not on appeal for the rule I just articulated,
right.
Because the faculty member who brought the action against the college for giving release time appealed it because she's asking the appeal court to tell the commission that they have to pay back his salary. Because, see, the Public Employees Relations Commission says, since we're kind of articulating this law in sort of a new way, we're not going to have any remedy against the union or Miami-Dade College, but going forward, our rule is going to be prospective, not retrospective with a remedy. So she is brought the appeal. So the rule articulated by...
By the board.
By the board was not appealed by the college.
So just
or
to make
by
sure,
the union.
By the union.
So make sure, it isn't a court that's settled this, it's just the board has settled this, and it's being now moved into the court system to be challenged via appeal. Am I misunderstanding that?
Yeah, yeah, it's only being challenged, the remedy's being challenged.
Right.
Not the rule.
Okay.
You see what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
because
yeah.
she won on the rule, and she's the appellate.
So. Okay, well, we'll have to...
Yeah,
I'm gonna look at that one.
Okay.
And she's appealing the remedy because PERC says we're not going to order anybody to pay any money back. Everything is prospective. Just do not release these individuals for these practices in the future. You can only release them for these practices.
Okay.
Yeah, they defer to PERC's interpretation of Chapter 447. And she's appealing the unfair labor
practice complaint. She filed an unfair labor practice complaint against the college because the college was releasing individuals. And she was saying that's a violation of the law.
Yeah.
But we don't have language for any of that, but it's new. It's only been out like less, I guess it's about.
Just a month.
A month.
Yeah.
So.
Barely a month.
I just want to make this a little bit more clear what we've put in here, because we've always said that we release time, we couldn't reasonably evaluate what you do for the union on your release time. So that would not be considered part of your service. And we want to make sure that we don't, that that's not just for release time, that you that service, attending union meetings or working on a membership committee or something, even if you're not on release time, that can't be considered university service, because if it is, then we have to be able to evaluate it. And it really, you don't want us evaluating your participation in union activities. Or do you? I mean, it can work.
I don't think we can.
No, not under this new rule.
Because that way, we would be kind of...
Conflict of interest.
We would be impacting your right under... the act and under the Constitution, because we would, what if somebody were to say, you did a lousy job as a union representative, and I'm going to, you know, take things away to reduce your evaluation. Sure. You know, it's not for us to say. That would not be our position.
Yeah.
Yeah, the only difficulty is that some union activities certainly qualify as professional. You know, membership in a professional organization. And so then that would count the same way as being a member of any other professional society.
But that's not your service assignment, though, is it? I don't think it's in service. Well, I don't think
it's
we can have
our service.
Well, then we'd have to break that out, because those other professional societies do not have the same kind of standing as a certified collective bargaining representative does. We have a law that requires us to refrain from crossing a line and becoming involved in your organization. We cannot take action that would impact what you do.
Right.
And so we can't evaluate you, and we can't say you're doing this at our assignment. We cannot assign you to be a member of a union. Or to be active in a union.
Oh no, that's understood. Right.
Or to be active in a union.
But in general, service assignments, so are you distinguishing?
I mean, we can't say somebody gets, we're assigning somebody to come here today and sit at your side of the table.
Well, let's caucus, because I need to find something.
Okay.
Yeah. I know what I want to ask.
Do you need anything else?
My question is, how I assess for my national committee work, other than the fact that I sit on that national committee?
Which national committee?
On a National Committee for Disability and Disability in the Profession Committee at the American Academy of Religion.
I don't know how that is, but what I'm saying is that this organization has a particular legal standing, and we cannot assign you or evaluate you on this activity.
But none of the service is assigned. We participate in, service is something we participate in as part of our responsibilities as faculty members, but we're not assigned to specific service.
But look at it another way. You have a constitutional right in Florida to participate in an employer organization or not. You can oppose it. You can actively campaign against it, or you can be actively support it. We cannot in any way take that into consideration in anything we do as an employer. We can't give you credit for it. We can't take adverse action against it. It's protected, concerted activity. So just like we can't give somebody a kudo for doing it and not a kudo for attacking it, and we can't be in that position of assigning or giving any kind of acknowledgement for someone's participation for or against this organization. You're in a completely different legal standing.
If I may also, I think there's a distinction between the type of service that you'd have with UFF and with a professional organization related to your discipline. That's part of your assignment because presumably your activities with that professional organization impact how you teach and impact the research that you do. Being an officer in the UFF isn't going to impact how most of us teach. I mean, there may be people teaching human resource management or something like that where they could perhaps make an argument, but somebody in engineering can't, and I don't think somebody in biology can. Those are different.
Yeah, we could not have, for example, a person who was on our faculty and became the president of the National Right to Work organization and is writing and suing employer organizations regularly and saying how they should be banished and trying to enact laws against them and trying everything they can to oppose what you do. We can't say, we're going to recognize that as good service to the community. We can't get involved in that.
If it's servicing the faculty, and that's what the service in terms of the UFF is, just like mm-hmm. servicing faculty by having workshops and servicing faculty, it's providing a service for part of the community at UCF. That would just be the only thing I would put out
no,
there. I understand you can't evaluate, so I understand you can't cross that line, but that's different than this being another avenue of service that we ourselves can volunteer to participate to better our community of faculty, which is...
But what do you want to... But then I don't understand. I mean, we're not saying you can't do that. You can do that. But we're just saying that that's not an event that impacts what we do on this side.
Yeah.
But you're also saying we cannot receive service...
You can't get credit
for it as service, and that's really what the contention is.
Right. Because
that's
a...
It's not whether or not you can stop us from doing it.
No.
But
if
we give you credit, we're doing something...
If
we give credit to you, then we are taking action on this side of the table.
But the question is about us receiving credit for it as service. Mm-hmm. And our interpretation is it is service. And your interpretation is it can't be service. So that's obviously what the...
Look at it from a chair's perspective. A chair may assign Nick to participate in the organization or suggest that there be professional organizations that he be involved in for furthering the discipline. Participating in UFF as an officer doesn't further the discipline, so it's not part of a faculty assignment. That's how I would look at it from
Well, it does in the respect that we have shared governance.
It's also closed.
Right.
It's a closed organization, though, right? I mean, I can't attend workshops.
If you're a member, you can.
Yeah.
Welcome to join. She can't be. She can't be, and she can't go to your workshops. Because that's an unfair labor practice. She's a part of management.
Well, she may have to change her hat, but she could join us in terms of...
No, she couldn't.
No.
She'd have to quit her job.
No.
She'd have to quit her job because...
Exactly, but she could do it. She doesn't need from doing it.
No,
it's
I
nice
know.
You guys but it's... willing to support me.
You can come our side anytime.
Okay, so anyway...
And we don't want Charlie. We don't want to lose Charlie.
Aw, that's very sweet of you to say. So shall we go to caucus then and what you think about
No, let's go to caucus. It's a good time to go to caucus.
It's not true.
So you have any questions for us on 24?
No.
I don't think so.
Oh.
All right. Well, we have one question for you on Article 8 then.
Okay, great.
And so this is on page 3 at the very top. The sentence in blue. The similarly, a non-renewable, non-searched appointment may not exceed a total of 12 months. And so we're trying to figure out what kind of appointments are they?
The people that you can appoint without a search.
Okay.
It is putting in the language what our practice is.
And so those are visiting appointments or all appointments?
1 year non-searched appointments. So your chair can say, okay, I want that one adjunct, we're going to hire them for 1 year to cover this spot.
Yeah, but we don't represent adjuncts. See, that's where I'm...
No.
Okay, we hire this person for a year to cover the spot.
No, it's perfect. That's exactly what it is. Sometimes maybe one of your colleagues is going on sabbatical and now there's a couple of courses that you can't cover, but there is someone that you're familiar with who's helped you out on a part-time basis in the past. Frequently we'll hire that person for a year without a search and the appointment's not renewable.
Stop gaps.
Exactly. That's exactly what it is.
You can only do that one time in your career at UCF, so you can't just...
Okay, but
it's to prevent abuse to an employee.
Right. But then... Could the person, so let's say that person, you know, is someone that you know, they do a super job, and then you want to appoint them as a visiting following that.
You have to search.
They have to do a search.
Yeah.
But then it wouldn't change the time clock on the visiting appointment.
Have 3 more years.
3 more years instead of 4.
Right.
Okay.
Because they've used a year.
Okay.
Because otherwise people would keep, you know, they would keep someone in a visiting position. That's an abuse.
Right. No, I was just trying to figure out what sort of positions they were and the time clock and how that would impact the visiting appointments. And because I know we've had, at least we've had discussions about some units maybe not understanding how the visiting worked and not not being able to add the years together.
Well,
it wasn't quite that simple, but. Any other questions from our side?
Yeah, on 8.1c, we had a question about the language you used there. Continue to support. What does that mean?
Up here on the
8.1c in red.
Just, I think we have talked about before that that's a good thing to support spousal hires, that, you know, it does help with recruiting and so forth, and we were just agreeing with that we would like to do that when we can.
And we'll probably suggest actually striking the "where practicable" part, just to make that a, because it doesn't really change the preceding portion of supporting, and it makes it a more powerful statement, and so exactly for that reason, for recruiting.
But it doesn't, UCF's not compelled to do so with what's already written there without practical. It's not a contract language.
It's aspirational.
It's aspirational.
Right. Yeah.
And Patty, I think you had a concern about spousal, the use of spousal.
I think one of the, that's up to, I want to see if John wanted to bring that.
No, I think we're good on that.
Okay.
That's all the questions.
Okay.
Oh, that's right. So.
Well, she will be. Our team will be sending you days as soon as we check.
So hopefully Wednesday mornings, just so, because we're going to start getting our schedules filled up too, and if we can.
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
We're going to get slammed in about another week.
Yeah.
when do classes start? 22nd.
August
15th.
22nd.
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 In many ways, 2 weeks ago. Emails for students already.
Yeah, and our next session is the 3rd of August.
We are done.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Okay.